Local news, culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. Thank you so much for being here with us this evening. I'm your host, Jason Dole. But not for long. I'm about to hand things over to Bill Williams, because it's time once again for the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction, only here on Radio Catskill's Local Edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project, information and awareness about the heroin and opiate epidemic. I'm Julie Pizzol. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pizzol, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
Thanks, Julie. My guest this evening is Kevin Heyer. Kevin is the CEO of the Heyer Calling Foundation, a Philadelphia-based 501c3 nonprofit organization with a satellite location outside of Richmond, Virginia. Kevin is a management side labor employment attorney and long-term recovery from methamphetamine use disorder. The Heyer Calling Foundation advocates for the recovery community in the workplace by helping highly motivated people in recovery get a second chance at a career through individualized, no-cost support services not covered by insurance. The Heyer Calling Foundation also educates organizations on the benefits of creating a recovery-friendly workplace. A graduate of Penn State School of Labor and Employment Relations and the University of Baltimore Law School, Kevin serves as board counsel to Faces and Voices of Recovery and is on the board of the Florida Recovery-Friendly Workplace Coalition. In the 10 years prior to forming the Heyer Calling Foundation, Kevin practiced law at SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania, Compass Group USA, and Obernayer, Rebman, Maxwell & Hipple, LLP. Welcome to the Kingfisher Project, Kevin.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
I was listening to somebody say something on the radio yesterday about the chicken and the egg, and then I thought, which came first with you, the law education or your meth use?
Oh, actually, this might surprise people. The law education came much, much sooner. I had a 10-year run practicing law before this all happened.
Really?
So, yes.
I ask most everybody I talk to about addiction this one way or another. Prior to your meth use, earlier in life, did you have any experience with drugs?
I didn't.
You're an anomaly.
My story is unique. Everyone's story is powerful. And, you know, mine is unique, though, in the sense that I fell into drug use in my 30s. I drank in high school and college but I matured out of it in law school. You know, I had very little history with drug use when I tried methamphetamine. You know, we'll use a lot of our time on it, but I was about to turn 40. I'd ended a relationship. Someone offered it to me in a moment of insecurity, impulsively tried it. And within 8 weeks, I was out of a job and in the grips of a very serious crystal meth addiction.
Wow. How long were you using?
I was addicted for 2 years. So it wasn't short either. I mean, it went on for 2 years before I finally hit bottom and went to rehab.
When you said hit bottom, was there a particular event or had you just had enough?
No, I wish I could say I'd had enough. No, I overdosed. And was on dialysis for 10 days. And that finally forced this issue to the surface with my friends and family. A few of my friends knew about this, but certainly not my family, who of course wouldn't have because I was, 40 years old and living on my own. But at that point, I went into treatment and started the journey out and it led to all the cool things we're doing today at the Heyer Calling Foundation.
I'm unfamiliar. I lost my son, I think, as many of our audience know, I lost my son to heroin. What is a meth overdose like?
Yeah, meth is a stimulant, whereas heroin is an opiate. In my case, what happened was I had used too much of it, and it was laced with something adulterated. Not sure exactly what it was. I think fentanyl was part of it. But the bottom line was my kidney shut down. And that had me on dialysis for 10 days. It was very scary. And when I did OD on it, I was outside. I didn't do a lot of detail just because of time constraints, but I was found along a rural road in Virginia when I OD'd. And I went to the hospital, and it just that began the long, long, long journey out of us.
Wow. You say long, long journey. How long was your recovery? How long did it take before you yourself were working again?
Well, I'm self-employed. I was blessed. It was that expression, there by the grace of God go I. I did not have justice involvement, and my law licenses never got affected by this. I was just a messed up end user, only hurting myself. So I could have gone back to work, but I chose to start the Higher Calling Foundation being self-employed. We started that. And I say we because we had some other folks around it, my family, April 26th of 21. So, yeah, it took within about 2 years. And after I left rehab, we started this. And we're going on 4 years old, and I'm really proud of some of the things we've done. From the darkness of and horror of addiction can come the beauty of recovery and the hope we offer.
I've heard variations of that story, that theme, over and over from guests.
Sure.
People who have been addicted, been through addiction, and are some of the most remarkable, talented, gifted, and giving people.
You're working a strong program of recovery, and it can be spiritual or not. There's no one way to do it. Yes, there's the 12-step model, but there are many others, like SMART Recovery, She Recovers Foundation for Women, Dharma. There are a bunch of programs out there. If you're working a program, I believe, it makes you a better person. You're going to be incapable of lying. Not taking responsibility. I mean, you can come out of addiction a better version of yourself, personally and professional.
Did you involve yourself with any particular program?
Yeah, I personally am a 12-step guy, but I don't proselytize it. And I certainly do not say it's the only way to do it. But I found that the 12-step model, belief in a higher power, is what got me sober. That and a lot of therapy. There's no medicated assistant treatment. It's known as MAT in the field for stimulant use disorder. And that's an umbrella that would include crystal meth addiction, cocaine use disorder, all of the prescription stimulants like Adderall, Ritalin. There's no medication for that. It's ultimately a lot of work in a hard program and therapy and just the support of other people, love and support with accountability.
And thinking about this interview, I'm thinking about your name. You've got a great name for a high...
Higher, H-Y-E-R, is the word I use for higher calling, like a higher power, higher calling in life.
Yeah.
Of course, that's what addiction on the 12-step model comes from. So this is a higher calling for me.
Well, exactly. There's a higher calling. There's your own name. And then you help people get hired.
I do. That's the nuts and bolts of what we do. From what I went through, I use my skills as a labor and employment attorney, representing management. So I come from corporate America. To help highly motivated, I'll always say it that way, highly motivated people in recovery get a second chance. And what that does for them, it saves their lives. It helps break the intergenerational cycle of addiction because so often it runs in families, whether it's genetic or just through the life circumstances, it's trauma that gets self-medicated by drugs and alcohol. And, we believe that the security of employment, which helps anybody, whether you have addiction issues or not, can go a long way to breaking that cycle.
How do you, when people come to you, I assume people come to you, do you seek people out as well?
No, not really. I mean, if I knew of somebody who had problem and was, well, let me strike that. I misspoke. If I knew someone who was in, we don't recruit people who actively have addiction because they need to have some time under their belt before they can work with us. I've shared what we do with people who might benefit, but no, I mean, there's such a need for this that they come to us. So if they meet our eligibility requirements, we automatically assign them to one of our career coaches. And then we figure out with them, what do you need? What does this individual need to get a second chance? So we create a blueprint. What is it going to take? And our services are really individualized. Everything from help getting a license reinstated to expunging certain end user convictions like a DUI or a simple possession, paraphernalia. We helped a woman expunge a prostitution conviction. She was 20 years old. And we felt, the right thing to do was get rid of that. She didn't need to be shamed by that 20 years into recovery. So we do stuff like that. We do job placement. We have a mentoring program.
How do you sort out? How does I come to you and I say, I've had this problem, I'm in recovery. How do you sort out whether my intentions are genuine or not? Or maybe the question is, do you ever have to say to somebody, not now, come back and talk to us in a while?
Well, it's so funny you say that. We would never say no. At worst, it would be not right yet. Excuse me, not yet. Not right now. Not yet. There's a degree of subjectivity, you know, but it's a group consensus decision. I mean, obviously, you've got to be able to pass the drug and alcohol test. That's a given. We use the number of 18 months of recovery to be placed into a job. Now, again, everything's fact specific. There are differences, but a lot of it's, are you working a program? Do you have people in your life supporting you? Because the last thing you'd ever want to do is set someone up for failure. So if they don't have the support in their life to go back to work where there's going to be stress, we'll, you know, if they're okay with this, their life, but our guidance would be to slow the pace down and let's get that support around you before we send you back to work or get you a part-time job, maybe to get you some income. While we sort all that out.
Right. Well, you also have your own interest. You have the interest of the organization. It doesn't do the organization any good to have somebody come in and then relapse.
It's not fair to our donors and our supporters to place people that are not serious. And even if they're serious, because I don't think we typically have issues with people not being serious. It's a question of, have they had enough time? Are their expectations realistic of what they're going to be able to do? Now, another service we offer that I'm really proud of is some instances you can't go back to what you did before. We had a client, 3 DUIs in Virginia as a felony. She couldn't go back to a role that revolved around insurance and banking. But rather than dwell on that, we focused on what could he do? What were their skills that could be transferred into other areas? And we were able to help him with them. So whatever we do, it's a message of positivity. It's, what can you do now? And if you can't do it now, when can you do it? Or what can you aspire to? And we've got over 80 success stories at this point, some more prominent than others, but they're successes and we're very proud of it.
It sounds like the positivity that you've been discussing sounds a lot like Kraft.
Oh, the Kraft model?
Yes.
Yes, community model. I'm familiar. Certainly that's some of it. You know, now I won't tell you, I haven't had conversations. We had one young man who I looked him in the eye and I said, from God's lips to your ears, if you keep selling drugs, you're going to go to the penitentiary. You know, so we're real. And he's now a success too. We took a chance on this guy and he's done really, really well. So yeah, we're positive, you know, but we're also real with people that the end game of jails, institutions, and death is often true. You know, I mean, it's a terminal illness if it's not addressed.
There aren't many people like you that have an established career that suddenly fall into some drug use and are able to go back and resume a career similar or parallel to what they've been doing. You must have a younger body of people that you need to help both educate and generate more use of their talent.
Well, you know, everyone's story is different. You know, there are parallels, there are themes. You know, people can fall into addiction at different points in life. I think you're correct. In many cases, it starts young, but when they do something about it, can vary. You know, and there are people, I mean, functional alcoholics and functional drug addicts, and I hate some of these words because they're jarring and they're stigmatized, but for our purposes, people know what it means. Functional alcoholics and addicts do exist. So someone may have years of a career before it blows up on them. But we believe, it's been my lived experience, I think many of your listeners might agree, addiction only tends to get worse. This is a progressive condition. So at some point, the plane's going to crash. We like to say when we do education on this, the sooner you address it, the easier it is to get out of it. But it's not unheard of for someone to come to me at 40 or even older and say, look, I want to get my life together. And we try to work with people. We're not in the business of trying to turn people away. That's why I said it's always a not yet when we have to. And by the way, that when it's really a no, it's on placing you in a job. There's other stuff we can do for someone, like career counseling, career coaching, that doesn't require that same criteria. The biggest weight is when we're putting our name behind you on a job. But offering you some career counseling, it doesn't take a lot to get that, as long as we know you're in good faith and you're working the homework you're being given.
I noticed on your website, you have a significant number of career counselors.
We do. We have a team of well, it changes, and it given what I'm doing at times, I'm not even always fully aware of the number, but it's somewhere around 22, 23 right now of different people. Now, some are volunteers, some are contractors. We don't have paid staff yet. We have 1199, but we're growing. And yeah, they're different coaches. What we'll do is we'll match you up with a coach who has the time and is a good fit for you. You know, some people are going to mesh with someone else versus another individual, you know, and we've got a terrific board and advisory council, and everybody will make themselves available if it makes sense to a client.
Are your counselors located mainly in the Philadelphia and Richmond areas, or are they all over?
No, they're spread out. You know, I mean, most of this can be done remotely. The relevance of the region comes down to job placement, and our network is going to be stronger in the Mid-Atlantic. Yeah, I'm thinking of a counselor or a coach, excuse me, a coach. We don't provide formal counseling like a therapist would. We provide career counseling.
Right.
That's not the same thing. We're not licensed to do that. That's not our strength. It's consulting on how to get back to work. And my background as a management side labor and employment attorney gives me a unique insight into this. And then I can go out into business community and advocate for the folks in recovery and say, listen, there is a business case, a legal case for hiring them. And there is. There's undeniably a case for recovery-friendly workplaces.
You're listening to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm Bill Williams. After the break, more with my guest, Kevin Heyer. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is our one chance, the one window we have to see the world as Doge sees it. And looking closely at that, I think gives us a lot of clues about what actually motivates Doge, what actually motivates the cuts they're making, and some sense of where their effort is going to go from here.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
After a whirlwind month, President Trump will address Congress and the nation for the first time since being inaugurated. I'm Ari Shapiro. Join us for live special coverage from NPR News.
Tonight at 8 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition. I'm your host, Bill Williams, and I'm talking with Kevin Heyer, CEO of the Heyer Calling Foundation. Are there any industries or any jobs or areas where you have more people getting employment and the opposite of that, areas where it's a little harder to get people?
Well, you know, the more professional the role, the more licensure requirements around it, like healthcare law, the more barriers there can be to getting back into it. But we have a pretty well-balanced group of folks we work with. You know, obviously we get some attorneys just because of the fact I'm a lawyer. You know, if you have bar association issues, you can go back, but it takes time. One of the things we're also out there trying to do, and even just podcasts like this, you know, help spread a message. We got to give people a real second chance. And when we create so many barriers that they give up, that's not healthy either. Now, I'm not saying, to be clear, we have to have some requirements in place for healthcare professionals or law enforcement officers or lawyers or many different professions, teachers. But at the same time, in America right now, the pandemic led to a surge in substance use. The stress, the isolation of it, it exacerbated what was already a crisis in America. So if we're going to address this, we also have to have pathways to helping people get back to work. Because if you create too many barriers, they give up. When they give up, nothing good comes from that. More than likely, they're going to return to substances, the one thing that gave them comfort. Or even if they don't, they can't support their families. They can't be a contributing member of society. That's not good for anybody.
Yeah. You say most of your staff is volunteer staff?
Yeah, we have some contractors. It's a mixture. I mean, the board and advisory council is all volunteers. The others are contractors.
And
we pay as needed. Like if we match you up with someone, in most instances, there's a fee, or they're using this to get certain hours of credit for licensure. But yeah, it's very expensive to operate this. And we're supported through private philanthropy, some corporate sponsorship. We're not currently pursuing grants, but that day will probably come. I mean, we're only 4 years old, so we're still kind of just at that place where we're springboarding. But You know, we're getting there. We've been on NBC has featured this, the Associated Press, Bloomberg, Today in Medicine. My former firm, I actually now work with, I exited over my problems with methamphetamine. Today is my biggest collaborator on promoting recovery-friendly workplaces, Obermeyer, Ribbon, Maxwell, and Hipple. Terrific people and terrific lawyers. And we go out there together in some instances and make the case together. You know, there's a business case for this. There's a legal case for recovery-friendly workplaces. Are you familiar with them?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Sorry to say.
Well, let me give you, your listeners, I think, is less than so much about me and even our foundation. The biggest message I want people to take away is the case for recovery-friendly workplaces. Because what that means is this is an employer who runs a business. They're holding everyone accountable to the same standards. But what they're saying is we understand that substance use disorder, which is a newer term for the disease of addiction, is an issue in our communities, and we've got to talk about it. So they're going to make their employment, their workplace safe to talk about this stuff. They're going to have a culture where if someone has an issue with drugs and alcohol, they can go to their manager and they can go to HR, and the focus is going to primarily be, can we salvage this employee? We're not looking to fire you. Now, obviously, in some instances, you're going to have to exit an employee. My termination made sense at the time. But sometimes it doesn't make sense to terminate someone. And if you have legal requirements to send them to rehab, like Family and Medical Leave Act or certain provisions under the Americans with Disabilities Act, they're legal requirements. And there's so much benefit that comes to an employer with a recovery-friendly workplace. By hiring people in recovery, they're getting grateful, very determined workers who have a lot of self-awareness, perseverance, willingness to collaborate, willingness to take a look in the mirror and admit when they're wrong. There are so many benefits, lower healthcare costs, lower workers' comp claims, increased engagement. I mean, there's so much of what it does for the families too. There's so many families suffer in silence from the stigma of addiction. And to have a workplace that supports you and your family, what do you think that can do for people? Imagine if an employer, because we promote these ideas, had employee resource groups for people in recovery, like they do for vets or LGBT or something like that. If you had an employee resource group for people in recovery and their families, how amazing would that be? You know, if you knew you had a coworker that was sensitive to it. And if you had a coworker that for whatever reason didn't want to get around it, that's fine. They just don't engage with it. And that's their right too. It doesn't mean they have a problem with it. It just means at this time they're not engaging in it. Now imagine if employers took open job postings to alumni programs of rehabs. That's what the rehabs call their former patients, alumni. Said, hey, we have some job openings. We especially encourage you to apply. Doesn't mean they have to hire any particular person, but it still gives you that sense of wholeness that experience you had may make you a better employee, because it does. It does. I'm not just spinning this. It does.
Do you work with any organizations that are similar to yours in that they are either founded by or use a large number of people in recovery?
Sure. Yeah, we have quite a few collaborators. You know, one initiative we're doing right now, it's kind of neat. We're working with a nonprofit in the Philly area called The Wardrobe, which provides free clothing to low-income individuals and families. You know, many of those folks have been touched by addiction, maybe not everyone, but it's a safe bet a lot of them have. So we like to work with allied groups. We will work with sober living houses, you know, those chains that operate housing for people in early recovery to give them a safe place to live with some structure. We'll work with that. The Bridgeway School is a recovery high school in Philly, yet we raise gift cards for their students. You know, we raise clothing for The Wardrobe. You know, we're very much engaged in the community, you know, because this is all comes together. It's all a continuum of support that takes you from active addiction into the hope and promise of recovery. And then it helps your family. I mean, I say to people, think about it. If mom and dad aren't incarcerated, there's less to traumatize children. It's not that controversial. If mom and dad have steady employment, there's going to be a more secure home life for a child. That's the trauma and the pain that they can grow up to self-medicate. So we're never going to stamp addiction out like smallpox. It's not going to happen. But we can do a lot to place a dent in it by providing these resources to highly motivated people and helping employers see the benefits of hiring them. That's how we see it.
Do you have any connections with sober groups in colleges and universities?
That's a terrific question. There is an organization that we've supported, Students Recover. You know, I have a lot of respect for young men and women in recovery because not that it's ever easy, but at their point in life, you know, alcohol and drugs can be more socially acceptable. We don't do anything specific with a particular university. However, I'll tell you, we went into Temple Law in Philadelphia. We being Obermeyer, my former firm, who I reestablished a relationship with, and Recovery Centers of America, we sometimes do projects with, to talk to the students about the culture of drinking in the law. You know, the stat that we use is 20% of practicing attorneys have some form, mild, moderate, or severe alcohol use disorder. And that's just looking at alcohol. That doesn't even get into the abuse of prescription medication, you know, and other things. No, it's probably not typically methamphetamine, but addiction's addiction. It doesn't really matter what the substance is.
Yeah, well, we talk about ending addiction, and as you just alluded to before, we're never going to end addiction. I think we can comprehend addiction.
We can do a lot to lessen the effects of it and break the cycle of it. That's what I feel like. You know, there's not a cycle of cell phone, you know, addiction. That's a little out there. Many families have a cycle of generational trauma and addiction. The beauty, if there's anything positive about what we're talking about, is you can recover from even the most severe substance use disorder. And I'm proud of it. I was injecting methamphetamine. You're at the end of the line then. There is nothing more hardcore you can do. Okay. You're at the end. You know, it's the most addictive drug. I was using it in the most extreme way. Not proud of it, but it was part of my story. And I came back from it. And many other people do. This isn't unique to me. Anyone can recover with the right support. And their employers can become better off too. That's what motivates me. I mean this so sincerely, Bill. And I think you know this seeing me, and I hope your listeners can hear me because you see it in my facial expression. We are sincere. The people I have at my foundation are believers. We're in it for the right reasons, which isn't always the case in the business of recovery. We want to help other people get a second chance like we got. So we're out there, and if your listeners have any questions, they're welcome to reach out to me. I may direct them to someone else, but, you know, more than likely, I'll at least probably respond to the email before passing them off to someone else. My email is Kevin, K-E-V-I-N, hyercalling.org, K-E-V-I-N, hyercalling.org. Sure. And our office line is on the website, and they can find me on LinkedIn. If someone wants to find me, there's enough out there to do that. So, you know, even if someone's 5 years into recovery and they're saying, look, I'm going through a tough time, which doesn't necessarily mean they're using substances, or a family member. I'll tell you this, we've worked with family members. We had a client come in and say, look, I actually don't have addiction issues, but my career got hurt because of my loved ones, because I missed too much work. So we'll even work with family members. If they can demonstrate that they truly were affected professionally by a loved one's substance use, we'll work with them too. And it's all free. I mean, we certainly appreciate if people have the means and they want to make a donation. We certainly appreciate it, but it's never a condition of getting services.
That's all the time we have for the Kingfisher Project. My guest has been Kevin Heyer, CEO of the Heyer Calling Foundation. Thank you for an informative and inspiring conversation about finding a way to combat the stigma around substance use disorder and finding ways for those in recovery to rejoin the workforce. Thank you, Kevin.
Absolutely. Thank you.
There's more to my interview with Kevin Heyer. Hear our full conversation on the Kingfisher Project podcast at wjffradio.org. You can also find past interviews with great guests, authors, advocates, policymakers, and those in recovery. All up now at WJFFradio.org. And be sure to join me right here next month for a new edition of the Kingfisher Project, Information Against Addiction. I'm Bill Williams. Thank you so much for listening tonight.
Big thanks to Bill Williams for doing the Kingfisher Project. Thank you for listening. Do keep on listening on air. Always live streaming at WJFFradio.org, which is where you can go to hear the rest of that conversation on the Kingfisher podcast. This has been the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back tomorrow evening to do it all over again. Coming up at 7, we've got Music Emporium with Mr. Kusar Grace. But first, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
WJFF.